Welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc of the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the Washington Post, from Newsweek, from 538.com, and more. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And podcasts of this and other episodes of Religion in the News may be found at our website, ncreadingservice.org. We begin this week on Religion in the News with an article published on April 28th in the Washington Post. And the article is entitled, Holocaust Survivor and Jewish Author Elie Wiesel Engraved into Washington National Cathedral. This article is by Michelle Borstein of the Washington Post. The designers of the massive Washington National Cathedral, as close as the United States might have to a national house of worship, left its limestone uncarved in multiple key spots, openings for cathedral leaders as time goes on to consider which people and ideas most need spiritual honoring. This fall, cathedral leaders, citing a rise in anti-Semitism and the need for dialogue, will unveil the building's first modern Jewish icon, Elie Wiesel. The sculpture of the late Holocaust survivor, whose writings famously turned suffering and existential angst into human rights activism, was completed on April 8th, Holocaust Remembrance Day. The likeness of the Romanian-born author and teacher is in a front vestibule called the Human Rights Porch, alongside those of Rosa Parks, Mother Teresa, and Jonathan Daniels, among others. The cathedral is a 20th century cathedral, with lots of room left on purpose, so we can keep lifting up those who we think live into the highest ideals of what we think it means to be a Christian, or a person of great morality and ethics, said the Reverend Randy Hollerith, the cathedral's dean and therefore its chief iconographer. We think he is an example to the whole country of resilience, someone who dedicated his life to the highest aspirations of what it means to be a human. The decision was made by Hollerith and other cathedral leaders around 2019, said its spokesman Kevin Ekstrom. The church is part of the Protestant denomination, the Episcopal Church, but aims to be a house of prayer for all people, where all can see something of themselves, he said. Once the denomination of much of the country's political elite, the Episcopal Church has hosted at the cathedral presidential funerals and inaugural prayer services, among other national spiritual events. The Human Rights Porch engravings, along with hundreds of other carvings and stained glass and other art through the English Gothic-style building, are part of the cathedral's efforts to be a multi-faith ecumenical institution. Wiesel is the first modern Jewish person, the many biblical Jewish figures aside, memorialized in the building. We wanted to be thoughtful that we do not do anything inappropriate or offensive, or even come close to appropriation. We didn't want to pretend he wasn't Jewish because he was. It was what made him who he was. But look at what he stood for. It crosses all religious traditions, Ekstrom said of Wiesel. That no one can be indifferent to suffering, to threats of violence, of genocide, that there is a universal human mandate to always be on guard against indifference to the suffering of others. The bust, which sits about 10 feet in the air in an arched doorway, will be dedicated this fall as part of a program with the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity. The program will honor his legacy, organizers said. Elie Wiesel has rightly been described as a messenger to humankind. He was a man deeply rooted in Judaism, but whose message of universal human dignity was intended for people of all backgrounds, said Sarah J. Bloomfield, the Holocaust Museum's director. Wiesel's son, Elisha, said he sees the cathedral as an American institution, and his father is a beautiful, humble American story. He noted that his father, in the 1950s a stateless journalist whose parents and little sister had been murdered in the Holocaust, became a U.S. citizen by accident when he wound up in a New York City hospital and mistakenly overstayed his visa. He was very gentle, and because of his experience, scared of officials. A customs official just suggested, you could become a citizen. It was the first time he'd been asked. I love that story, Elisha told the Post. His father, he said, pursued rights and peace by being gentle, always curious about other people, never turning away people who needed help. That's a very important part of my father's legacy. There's a lot today that calls for my father's memory and approach, he said, noting that he often sees people on social media or at social justice marches quoting Elie Wiesel. My father is quoted as saying, silence is the enemy. But I feel we've gone past indifference into screaming at one another. Cathedral stonemason Sean Callahan used medieval techniques to create the carving. He also did the depictions of Mother Teresa, Parks, Daniels, and other sculptures throughout the cathedral. Daniels was a seminarian and civil rights activist who was murdered in Alabama in 1965. The original model was sculpted by North Carolina artist Chaz Fagan, whose other works include the official White House portrait of former First Lady Barbara Bush and statues of Ronald Reagan and Billy Graham at the U.S. Capitol. Wiesel wrote 56 books, was a professor at Boston University, and the founding chairman of the Holocaust Museum, and won numerous awards, including the Nobel Peace Prize. He died in 2016. We'll turn next to an article from Newsweek magazine, and this article was published on April 28th. And the title of this article is Catholic Archbishop Joseph Naumann Says Biden Trying to Usurp Church's Authority with Abortion Policies. And this article is by Mary Ellen Cagnasola of Newsweek magazine. As attitudes about abortion rights shift under President Joe Biden's administration, Catholic archbishops in the U.S. are pushing back, even going as far as claiming that the president is attempting to usurp the church's authority with his abortion policies. Biden is the second Catholic president in U.S. history, and the first of the two to hold office while signaling support for abortion rights. The policy stance has upset bishops and inspired a sense of urgency to send a hardline message that such a stance is a grave moral evil, according to Archbishop Joseph Naumann of Kansas City, the Associated Press reported. At the next U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, a document will be prepared with the goal of clarifying the Church's stance on abortion that would also stipulate that Biden and other Catholic public figures with views favoring abortion rights should not receive communion. Because President Biden is Catholic, it presents a unique problem for us, Naumann, chairman of the USCCB's Committee on Pro-Life Activities, told the AP. It can create confusion. How can he say he's a devout Catholic and he's doing these things that are contrary to the Church's teaching? In accordance with existing USCCB policy, it would still leave decisions on withholding communion up to individual bishops. In Biden's case, the top prelates of the jurisdictions where he frequently worships, Bishop W. Francis Malooly of Wilmington, Delaware, and Cardinal Wilton Gregory of Washington, D.C., have made clear that Biden is welcome to receive communion at churches they oversee. The document in the works results from a decision in November by the USCCB's president, Archbishop Jose Gomez of Los Angeles, to form a working group to address the complex and difficult situation posed by Biden's stances on abortion and other issues that differ from official church teaching. Before disbanding, the group proposed the drafting of a new document addressing the issue of communion, a project assigned to the Doctrine Committee. The committee has not released details about its work. Naumann said the matter will be discussed at the USCCB's meeting in June, and the bishops will vote on whether the committee should continue working on the document so it could be publicly released later. A two-thirds majority would be needed for work to proceed, Naumann said. But even critics of the initiative, such as Bishop John Stowe of Lexington, Kentucky, predict the endeavor will win overwhelming approval. Stowe is among a relatively small group of U.S. bishops who worry that the USCCB's emphasis on abortion is also undercutting Pope Francis's exhortations for the Church to also stress such issues as climate change, immigration, and inequality. Stowe also worries that the U.S. bishops are missing a chance to find common ground with Biden on such issues. If a politician is targeted as a negative example by his own church, that sets a sad context in which the church can deal with this Catholic president, Stowe said. It contributes to the polarization of the church and of society. Bishop Robert McElroy of San Diego has expressed similar concerns. I do not see how depriving the president or other political leaders of the Eucharist, based on their public policy stance, can be interpreted in our society as anything other than a weaponization of the Eucharist to pummel them into submission, McElroy said during an online forum in February. Nonetheless, the bishops wanting to send a tough message to Biden are determined to press ahead. There's a growing sense of urgency, said San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Cordeleone. Abortion is not just one among many important issues. It's a direct attack on human life. Cordeleone envisions a statement from the USCCB to Biden and others that would move them in their conscience. They need to understand the scandal that is caused when they say they are faithfully Catholic and yet oppose the Church on such a basic concept, he said. American Cardinal Raymond Burke has broached the possibility of Catholicism's ultimate sanction. He said politicians who publicly and obstinately support abortion are apostates who not only should be barred from receiving communion, but deserve excommunication. Bishops, already troubled by Biden's stance on abortion, grew more dismayed by three measures from his administration in mid-April. It lifted restrictions on federal funding for research involving human fetal tissue. It rescinded a Trump administration policy barring organizations such as Planned Parenthood from receiving federal family planning grants if they also refer women for abortions. And it said women seeking an abortion pill will not be required to visit a doctor's office or clinic during the COVID-19 pandemic, enabling women to get a prescription via telemedicine and receive the pill by mail. Naumann, who issued strongly worded denunciations after each action, told AP he was frustrated that Biden could authorize these while identifying as a devout Catholic. "He doesn't have the authority to teach what it means to be Catholic. That's our responsibility as bishops," Naumann said. "Whether intentional or not, he's trying to usurp our authority." The Vatican has not ruled on the specific matter of communion and politicians supporting abortion in a major teaching document, though the Church's in-house canon law says people in a situation of persistent sin shouldn't be allowed to receive communion. It has also issued guidelines for the behavior of Catholics in political life, exhorting them to uphold principles consistent with Church doctrine. The then head of the Vatican's doctrine office, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, the future Benedict XVI, told U.S. bishops in 2004 that priests must deny the sacrament if a politician goes to receive communion despite an obstinate persistence in manifest grave sin, including the sin of consistently campaigning for permissive abortion laws. Ratzinger wrote a confidential letter outlining the principles to U.S. bishops in response to their question about whether to deny communion to John Kerry, who is the Democratic nominee for president. In the end, the bishops ignored Ratzinger's advice and voted instead for the policy currently in place, allowing bishops to decide themselves whether to withhold it. The document being drafted by the Doctrine Committee may contain some guidelines for bishops, Cordeleone said, but it will not seek to strip their decision-making authority. "This will put the burden of responsibility on Catholics who are prominent in public life," he said. Archbishop Samuel Aquila of Denver, who has sharply criticized Biden's abortion stance, told AP he favors creation of a national policy on communion as opposed to the current patchwork approach. He said bishops should first have a private conversation with an individual deemed to be in a state of sin and deny communion if they persist. Edward Peters, who teaches canon law at Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit, said the USCCB would have the option of seeking Vatican approval for a unified communion policy applying to all bishops, but he doubted such a request would be made. "The bishops' conference does have broad responsibility to speak out on matters that impact the effectiveness and clarity of the Church's mission," Peters said via email. "The bad example being given by some high-profile Catholics who consistently fail to protect innocent human life is surely one of those matters." Some Catholic academics are uneasy about the document. "Are you really going to deny communion for the President of the United States?" asked Margaret McGinnis, a religion professor at LaSalle University in Philadelphia. "I don't think this is going to shake his faith. I don't see anything constructive coming out of it." She noted that a majority of U.S. Catholics, according to polls, say abortion should be legal in at least some cases. Stephen Millies, a professor of public theology at Catholic Theological Union in Chicago, said the Catholic Church received significant financial support in recent years from conservative philanthropists who were skeptical of Francis and favored Donald Trump over Biden in the 2020 election. "What we're seeing now is an effort to please donors who want a church which will wage a culture war," Millies said. Our next article this week on Religion in the News comes from 538.com, and it was published in their weekly polling roundup nicknamed Pull Up Lusa. It was actually dated April 16th, but we're just getting around to it now. The title of this article is, "It's Not Just Young White Liberals Who Are Leaving Religion." And this article is by Brian P. Burge and Perry Bacon, Jr. of 538. Only 47% of American adults said they were members of a church, mosque, or synagogue, according to recently released polling that was conducted by Gallup throughout last year. It marked the first time that a majority of Americans said they were not members of a church, mosque, or synagogue since Gallup first started asking Americans about their religious membership in the 1930s. Indeed, Gallup's finding was a kind of watershed moment in the long-chronicled shift of Americans away from organized religion. It's possible the COVID-19 and the resulting suspension of in-person church services across the country heightened or accelerated the number of Americans disengaging from congregations. But these trends were long-standing, and the decline from 2018, 50%, was fairly small. So we think that the drop to 47% is unlikely to be explained simply by COVID-19. What's driving this shift? In part, it's about people who still identify with a religious tradition opting not to be a member of a particular congregation. Only 60% of Americans who consider themselves religious are part of a congregation, compared to 70% a decade ago, according to Gallup. But the bigger factor, Gallup said, is the surge of religiously unaffiliated Americans, people who are agnostics, atheists, or simply say they are not affiliated with a religious tradition. The rise of this group, sometimes referred to as nuns because they answer none when asked about their faith, and you know it's a play on words, isn't new. But the Gallup survey is part of a growing body of new research on this block. Let's look at some of the new insights about the nuns. By nearly all measures, the nuns now represent at least a fifth of all American adults, rivaling Catholics and evangelical Christians as the nation's largest cohort in terms of religious faith, or lack thereof. They are the fastest-growing religious/non-religious cohort. The nuns went from 12% of American adults in 1998 to 16% in 2008 to 24% in 2018, according to data from the General Social Survey. Gallup puts this group at about 21%. Pew Research Center says 26%. The Cooperative Election Study suggests their ranks are even larger, at about 32%. Why the confusion about the exact number? First, there's no universal method by which researchers ask people about their religious beliefs. For example, the GSS only offers one response option for the nuns, no religion, while the CCES offers three, atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. Secondly, Americans are still sorting out exactly how disengaged they are from religion, so even small changes in the way these questions are asked can affect the results. Compared to the U.S. population overall, non-religious Americans are younger and more Democratic-leaning. But the number of Americans who aren't religious has surged in part because people in lots of demographic groups are disengaging from religion. Many nuns don't fit that young liberal stereotype. The average age of a nun is 43, so plenty are older than that. About one-third of nuns, or 32%, are people of color. More than a quarter of nuns voted for Trump in 2020, and about 70% don't have a four-year college degree. The decline over the last decade in the share of black and Hispanic adults who are Christians is very similar to the decline among white adults, according to Pew. The number of college graduates leaving the faith is similar to those without degrees. The decline in organized religion is indeed much bigger among Democrats than Republicans and among millennials compared to baby boomers, but the trend is very broad. The growing diversity of nuns explains a lot of dynamics we see in America today. For example, unlike the civil rights movements of the 1950s and 60s, Black Lives Matter didn't emerge from black Christian churches and is not principally led by black pastors. Part of the story there is that some activists involved in BLM view black churches as too conservative, particularly in terms of not being inclusive enough of women and LGBTQ people. But another part of the story is simply that the Black Lives Matter movement was largely started by black people under age 50. Many black Americans under 50, like their non-black counterparts, are disengaged from religion. About a third of black millennials are religiously unaffiliated, compared to 11% of black baby boomers, according to Pew. The nuns can generally be broken down into three groups, agnostics, atheists, and a third block that is much larger than the first two and doesn't ascribe to a label, the nothing in particular block. According to CCES data from 2020, about 6% of American adults are atheists and 5% are agnostics, while 21% of Americans describe their religious beliefs as nothing in particular. Agnostics and atheists in particular tend to be disproportionately male, white, college-educated, and Democratic-leaning. Atheists in particular have fairly negative views about churches and religious organizations. In contrast, the nothing-in-particular block is more diverse, more people of color, more women, more Republicans, fewer people with college degrees. They tend not to have strongly negative views about churches and religious organizations. Also, people in this nothing-in-particular group, unlike the overwhelming majority of atheists and agnostics, sometimes join or rejoin religious denominations. About a quarter of those who were nothing-in-particular joined religious denominations from 2010 to 2014, while only about 13% became atheist or agnostic, according to an analysis of CCES data. And again, these numbers help explain some things happening in American culture and politics. The BLM movement has coordinated with black churches and black religious people, and that collaboration is likely eased by the fact that black nuns are rarely atheists or agnostics, and therefore don't have the negative feelings about churches and religious organizations that people in those groups often do. About 12% of non-religious black people are atheists or agnostics, compared to about 39% of religiously unaffiliated white people. Religiously unaffiliated Republicans usually aren't agnostics or atheists either, probably making it easier for them to remain in a party with a powerful evangelical wing. Only about 20% of Democrats are atheists or agnostics, which means they are fairly comfortable with an openly religious politician like President Biden as their party's leader. There are about as many evangelicals, 22% of American adults, Jewish Americans, 2%, black Protestants, 6%, and members of smaller religions in the U.S. like Islam and Hinduism, 6%, as there were a decade ago, according to GSS data. It's really two groups in particular that are declining, mainline Protestants and Catholics. Part of that decline is about young people. Elderly members of these denominations who die are not being replaced by a younger cohort. But older people are now increasingly shifting from Christian to unaffiliated too, particularly older people who lean left politically. As a result, mainline Christianity is not only declining but becoming more conservative. Between 2008 and 2018, three of the largest mainline traditions, the United Methodists, the Episcopalians, and the United Church of Christ, all became more Republican. People who leave Christianity often cite the politics of the Christian right turning them off. But some of the evidence here suggests that probably isn't the only explanation. There is a general disengagement of Americans from organized religion, people who are religious no longer identifying as members of a congregation. Republicans are becoming less religious, but they seem just fine voting for candidates who court the Christian right. And the people leaving Christianity aren't usually members of conservative evangelical congregations in the first place. So what else is going on? Well, nations with fairly high per capita GDPs, such as Germany, Japan, and the United Kingdom, tend to have fairly low levels of religiosity. The U.S. has always long been an outlier, a high-income, highly religious nation. But America may have always been destined to grow less religious. We'll wrap up this week on Religion in the News with an article from the Deseret News. This article was published on April 27th, entitled, What's the Biggest Threat to Religious Freedom in America Today? This article is by Kelsey Dallas of the Deseret News. Religion and policy experts agree it's grown harder in recent years for people of faith in the U.S. to live out their beliefs, but they have different ideas about which ongoing threat to religious freedom should be seen as most serious. Tevi Troy, who served as the White House Jewish liaison under President George W. Bush, believes the biggest problem facing American faith communities is intolerance. Across the country, people have become obsessed with telling each other how to live, he said during an April 22nd panel discussion hosted by Religious News Association. We have to have a little more respect for people of different views, he said. The Reverend Joshua Du Bois, who was one of Troy's co-panelists, offered a similar warning, although he directed it at a more specific group of people. He thinks faith leaders who supported President Donald Trump in the hopes of securing new religious freedom protections need to atone for Trump's divisive approach to leadership and rebuild trust within their communities. The voices who fight for religious liberty don't have any credibility anymore. I think it will take years to rebuild that, said the Reverend Du Bois, who worked as faith-related policy and served as a spiritual advisor to the president during the Obama administration. The Reverend Johnny Moore, who worked with the Trump administration, pushed back on this claim during the panel. However, he did agree that rising partisan tensions have put religious freedom at risk. My greatest concern is politics, he said, noting that religious liberty as a concept has become less popular as bipartisan cooperation has become more rare. The situation has gotten so out of hand that some government officials felt justified in forcing churches to shut down during the COVID-19 pandemic, the Reverend Moore added. What we've seen is the vast overreach of certain states, and it ought to cause all of us alarm, he said. Melissa Rogers, the current executive director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships, also drew people's attention to the events of the past year, highlighting moments in which churches or religious Americans were attacked. In the U.S. today, many people don't feel comfortable wearing religious symbols or sitting in a house of worship, and that should be heartbreaking for everyone, she said. Some people in the U.S. really feel like they are unable to practice their faith without fear for their personal safety. They can't walk down the street wearing a yarmulke or turban without fear that somebody will attack them, Rogers said. She and other officials in the Biden administration plan to do what they can to reduce this fear and boost religious freedom more broadly, she added. Already, they're working on increasing access to nonprofit security grants and hosting listening sessions with persecuted people of faith. I'm convinced that if every fair-minded American could sit and listen to someone who feels they cannot practice their faith without fear, then they would be on fire to change this, Rogers said. We'll wrap up this week with a little lighthearted article from Religion News Service that was published on April 21st, entitled Likes and Prayers, Facebook Tests New Prayer Post Feature. The idea for prayer posts grew out of the myriad ways users have connected over Facebook while distancing during the COVID-19 pandemic, according to a spokesperson. This is by Emily McFarlane Miller of Religion News Service. When the unfamiliar pop-up touting a new feature appeared on Robert P. Jones's Facebook, the CEO and founder of PRRI, Public Religion Research Institute, posted a screen grab to Twitter. "Wondering what FB algorithm thinks it knows about me," Jones mused. The new Facebook feature? Prayer posts. The function will allow members of Facebook groups to ask for and respond to prayer requests. A Facebook spokesperson confirmed to Religion News Service that the social media platform is currently testing the prayer post feature. The idea for prayer posts grew out of the myriad ways users have connected over Facebook while distancing during the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the spokesperson. Our mission to give people the power to build community extends to the world's largest community, the faith community, Nana Jones, head of Global Faith Partnerships at Facebook, said in a written statement to RNS. As a local church pastor with my husband, I know very well how disruptive the last year has been for people of faith and the houses of worship that service them, Jones said. This is why we are committed to finding ways to build the tools that help people connect to hope on Facebook. In its year in review, Facebook noted that the week of Easter and Passover 2020, which fell in early April, about a month into lockdowns across the country, saw the most group video calls ever on Messenger, Facebook's private messaging app. It also saw the most Facebook Live broadcasts from spiritual Facebook pages. Prayer posts are being tested within a subset of groups in the United States, according to Facebook. The spokesperson did not elaborate what criteria make up that subset. Group administrators must opt in to allow members to use the feature, which gives members the option to post prayer requests in the group. Other members can then click a pray button to let the original poster know they have prayed for their request. They can also choose a reaction, leave a comment, or send a private message to the poster. Facebook is also exploring additional tools to support faith and spirituality communities, including its Month for Good campaign during the Muslim observance of Ramadan, according to the spokesperson. We've reached the end of our time for this week. We certainly thank you very much for tuning in and hope you've enjoyed the program. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that this and other episodes of Religion in the News are available as podcasts on our website. Visit ncreadingservice.org, then click the Listen tab and select the podcast section. We appreciate you tuning in and hope you'll do so next time. I'm Brian LeBlanc, and this has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.